Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. This morning from Singapore, we have an ex-Schwarzman scholar, the founder of Atelier Wen, an HK-based D2C watch brand, and the current CEO of Zappi joining us. Please welcome Wilfred Byron. Wilfred, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's great to join you, Kunal. Thanks for having me.
And how are things in light of COVID with you in Singapore?
Things are not too bad. Things are slowly returning to normal as COVID vaccination rates are improving. But the government runs a tight ship here. So we got to be patient.
No, I'm happy to hear that. And hopefully the world finishes up this first phase of the first and second dose of the vaccines and everything kind of gets back to normal. So are you kind of seeing that over there?
We're seeing that in Singapore, which, is fortunate to have a system that, enables it to deliver these shots on a quite rapid basis. And, it's a small country, so it's easy to control, people in, people out, etc. Unfortunately, the rest of the broader region is definitely lagging behind with, widely varying vaccination rates, from Singapore to Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand, etc. So we're not seeing the end of the tunnel just yet in the broader region. And Singapore is looking a little bit more positive, but we'll have to wait a little bit longer for, the situation in the broader region to stabilize.
No, truly well said. And Wilfred, let's jump into the first question here, shall we?
Sure, yeah.
Tell me about yourself and your background and how it led you to the path of founding Zappi.
Happy to answer that. So my name is Wilfred. You pronounced that right. It can be tricky to pronounce. I'm from France originally, but I've actually spent most of my life in Asia. Which explains, why, most of my last projects have been in Asia. So I was born in Hong Kong. I grew up between Hong Kong and France. I then studied between the UK and China. So I spent 3 years in the UK and 2 years in China. I did my schooling in international schools, hence why I went to the UK, et cetera. And I'd been learning Chinese from a young age, right? So I started learning Chinese when I was about 12 years old, which is why I then, kept pursuing that. And I studied at Peking University. And then I did my master's, as you touched on, at the Schwarzman Scholar at Tsinghua University. I like to say that my interest in startups, as a French person living in France in the, second part of my teens, I guess, came from watching the movie The Social Network about Mark Zuckerberg, right, and the story of Facebook. The simple reason is that, I didn't have that much exposure to the world of startups, what startups were, that it was even possible to do this thing called startups. That's part of what I think makes, for instance, like the Bay Area and startup hubs such special places, is that, you're constantly surrounded by people doing these things, which make them seem, so much closer to your reach, right? That was not the case, when I was in France. Now is building more and more of a startup hub centered around Paris. But this is a pretty new thing. And back when I was in school, that certainly wasn't the case. And so watching that movie really sort of impregnated me with an interest in startups that I then further developed throughout university. So throughout university, I worked in a number of different startups. I had the benefit of spending some time in China, where I worked in some super ambitious, fast-paced startups, and those were actually like very formative experiences. And I also tried to start my own companies, right? So before starting Atelier One, this direct-to-consumer watch brand, I actually worked on two other businesses throughout university, both that had short lives in the end, but they were both very interesting experiences. And, as I was starting to think about what the next steps for me would be I was looking at like different paths, like your traditional like consulting or what have you. I'd worked 2 years well during university for McKinsey. So I was considering that as an option. But in the end, you know, nothing really appealed to me near as much as starting outright. And so I started making plans for doing that when I would finish the Schwarzman Scholars Program. And so that led me to starting my first company that really sort of, I'd say, became something, right? And so that's at 31, which I launched right after finishing university and, you know, took off relatively well from there. So today I still manage that company more as a side business. But after about a year and a half of doing that, I realized that I wanted to do something where the ceiling on growth was just like much higher. And I didn't see, you know, my first business kind of like ticking that box. So I decided to keep it on the side and then moved to Singapore from Hong Kong, where I was back then. I was doing that first business between Beijing and Hong Kong to Singapore. After a year of exploring like different businesses, etc., that led to the inception of Zappi, which has been going on for, you know, a little bit more than 6 months now, and it's been a great ride so far.
So Wilfred, Zappi really focuses on democratizing access to e-commerce for Southeast Asia's MSMEs, from my understanding.
Yeah, that's correct.
Can you tell us more about this and what the long-term vision of the company is?
For sure, yeah, happy to. So for the last couple of years already, I've been looking at the, you know, the MSME, so so-called micro SME space writ large, very carefully, right? So I guess another word that gets touted is, you know, the NBUs, next billion users. And just that trend of building business models to address this new wave of customers coming online for the first time, getting connected to the internet because of increasing internet penetration, smartphone penetration, you know, had always been a very interesting kind of concept and tendency to me. So, you know, I'd seen businesses in India, like for instance, Udaan, you know, reaching sky high valuations just a year, you know, from founding. I think, you know, they had reached unicorn status already by that point. Companies like Meitai in China addressing or disintermediating the value chain in the FMB business, essentially connecting food producers with end users like restaurants and what have you, you know, taking a cut in the middle. And again, producing tremendous results. So, you know, it had been a trend for the past couple of years and one that I was very interested in, but that I had not really found an entry point into just yet, right? And when I first arrived in Singapore, COVID was not yet about. It was about to come about a couple months later. But, you know, back then it seemed to me like that space of, you know, addressing the procurement side of the equation in the MSME space was a little bit, was addressed already, was, I don't want to say saturated, but, you know, there were a couple of companies going after that prize. And so it seemed to me like not the right time to do so. Now, fast forward a couple of months, I explored, you know, a bunch of different businesses throughout 2020. And I started seeing the early signs of what I thought was a new opportunity in the MSME space, which is that of enabling MSMEs to access e-commerce, right? So the basic premise is that during this pandemic, millions of businesses have had to rely on e-commerce as a lifeline, right? And that this is not going to change anytime soon. So e-commerce penetration, the use of e-commerce by small businesses and by consumers has just taken a leap into the future in Southeast Asia in a way that is really irreversible, right? And in the same way as, you know, it's occurred before in, say, Western markets with like Shopify and Magento and BigCommerce and WooCommerce, or in China with companies like Youdan, the largest SaaS company in China, which is an e-commerce enabler, or Baozun. You know, I think that what we're seeing right now is an inflection point that sort of heralds the possibility to build the e-commerce enablement tool of reference for the Southeast Asia region, simply because the context here is vastly different, right? You can't compare a small business in a third tier city in Indonesia or in Thailand or in the Philippines with, you know, an SME in Paris or in Vancouver or in New York, which is really the bread and butter of companies like Shopify, right? And the type of customer who, you know, those platforms were built for. And so what we're building addresses that specific gap, right? So we're building an e-commerce enablement tool that is tailored to Southeast Asian MSMEs. And so that means that, for instance, you know, it's mobile first, it's very lightweight, it's easy to use, because, you know, these consumers are not necessarily the most tech savvy, right? So put a relatively complex solution like Shopify in front of them, and you'll draw a lot of blank stares, right? It's also, you know, it also integrates with a wide variety of relevant third-party services. That could be payment gateways, which enable payments, methods of payments that are relevant to the consumers in which these businesses operate, in the countries in which these businesses operate, right? So that could be mobile payments, for instance, et cetera. With a Shopify that, you know, uses Stripe through and through, which enables only card payments throughout these regions, which account for a very small proportion of payment penetration, you can imagine that, you know, these tools become somewhat irrelevant. So we're putting an emphasis on localization of these integrations, so be it payment integrations or logistics integrations, to provide full-fledged e-commerce experience to our merchants from within one interface. So from, you know, digitizing their catalog, putting that online, integrating with payment services, integrating with logistics services, et cetera, et cetera. And there are a number of other integrations from like social media to e-commerce platforms, et cetera, that we're considering for the longer term. So, you know, right now we've been under development, you know, since earlier this year. We're at an exciting sort of milestone where we're planning on launching the beta in about 10 days now. And we're already getting really good feedback from, you know, customers who are signed up to use the first version of the product. And we've got high hopes for it. Now to address the latter part of your question, so what is the long-term play here? What is the long-term vision? Well, I'd say like e-commerce enablement in and of itself is an extremely compelling use case to go after. And we see this, you know, with Shopify, $200+ billion, with Yodan, $10+ billion, et cetera, right? This type of model has brought about extremely successful companies throughout the world, and I don't see any reason why it should be different in Southeast Asia. Now, I think in Southeast Asia, there's something else that is particularly interesting, and it's that e-commerce enablement right now is a use case that is just like in dire need. And it's therefore not only an opportunity to build an extremely successful e-commerce enablement business, but to also gain penetration and gain distribution in an MSME segment that is just thoroughly under-digitized end to end, right? So we're not only talking about, you know, they don't have tools that are suitable for them for e-commerce enablement. We're talking everything from like, you know, accounting to like staff management, procurement, financing, etc. There's very little built for these people. And so the longer term vision for Zappi is really to become the digital operating system of small businesses in Southeast Asia using e-commerce enablement, you know, as an extremely compelling use case in and of itself, but also as a tool to gain distribution in this market and then move into adjacent verticals. I won't go into too much detail as to, you know, which those could be, but, you know, they could encompass things like procurement and financing and other, you know, SaaS type tools to manage small businesses. So when you ask, you know, what the long-term vision is, I'd say, you know, digital operating system for Southeast Asian MSMEs is really what we're going after.
So this is the opportunity that you're trying to aim for with Zappi.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a tremendously impactful opportunity and a tremendously big one in terms of, you know, sheer dollar size.
Now, you know, when it comes to building a startup in Southeast Asia, you know, you look at, you know, the United States, which is a very developed market, versus Southeast Asia, which is, you know, an emerging market, right? Right. And you see this big difference that, let's say you raise a Series A in Southeast Asia, the average Series A, for example, it would be around $10 million, while in the US it's $30 million plus, right? So there's a huge liquidity difference, right? And that's because of the maturity of the markets. So what has, you know, really pushed you as a founder to build in Southeast Asia? What's really stuck out to you? Why not go and do this in the US, right?
Good question and a relevant one, right? So when I was thinking about that next step, the kind of, you know, obvious first option for me was actually looking at the Chinese market and returning to mainland China, you know, Beijing or Shanghai, and build my next business from there. That said, Southeast Asia as a region had been in my mind for the past couple of years already. And in fact, when I was in China back in 2017, 2018, Southeast Asia was already very much kind of touted as this next big opportunity, you know, a market or markets, which in aggregate, you know, were showing signs of resemblance to China perhaps like 20 years ago, when those category defining businesses like Alibaba and Tencent and JD and what have you were built. Whereas in China, after the effervescence of 2017-2018, which led to this you know, bubble, startup bubble popping with the likes of Didi and Mobike and what have you taking a hit, I think there was this sense that the Chinese startup ecosystem was overheating, that there was you know, too much competition, too few opportunities, too many players, and too much money to go after. And therefore, that Southeast Asia, you know, was quote unquote this land of opportunity where there is a tremendous amount of growth and relatively so a huge number of opportunities that come with that, and a relatively low amount of competition. And so looking at my next step, you know, Southeast Asia more and more looks like the obvious choice. Now, you know, that I'm not taking into account there some other opportunities that, you know, you could have mentioned, or some other possibilities like, you know, the US or Europe, right, which I think is quite an underrated start scene. One thing that I mentioned with regards to fundraising, you were talking about the average Series A being $10 million in this region, which I think might actually be a bit of an overstatement. I don't know the exact numbers, but $10 million is already a pretty good Series A right here, compared to like a $30 million in the US. One thing that I'll mention is that I think if you look at the purchasing power parity and, you know, how far you can actually go with that funding, you'll find that, you know, we're closer, in fact, in terms of purchasing power parity than the raw numbers suggest. With $10 million in Southeast Asia, you can go quite a bit further than you could in the US. And so, you know, all these elements put together decided me that Southeast Asia was the next market in which I wanted to spend, you know, my time and invest my time in building, you know, a large business.
So Wilfred, what have been some of the challenges of building a startup in Southeast Asia?
The first one I'll put out there, which I think is a common misunderstanding of Southeast Asia as a region, especially for outsiders, is that Southeast Asia tends to be spoken about as a, you know, as a unified kind of block and market, the Southeast Asia market by the Southeast Asia region, when in fact, you know, it's composed of widely different countries with widely different peoples and cultures and languages and regulatory systems, et cetera, et cetera, which can make it difficult or make it challenging to scale a business throughout the region in a way that is quite unique and very much different from, you know, markets, say like China, where, you know, you're going to have 1.4 billion customers connected, you know, to the same systems, speaking broadly the same languages, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a very, very stark difference. And, you know, it's something to grapple with, something that can be challenging, especially for certain sectors, which are, you know, quite regulatory dependent. Say healthcare, for instance, or fintech, it's really a challenge to grow those types of regulatory heavy businesses throughout the Southeast Asia region where you have all these different regulatory regimes. So that's certainly a challenge. The second one I'd say is, you know, monetization. This is still a region that is very much, or markets that are very much emerging. Now, you do have some differences with, say, you know, Malaysia being ahead of the game, or you know, somewhat closer to Singapore, perhaps, more middle-income country than Indonesia or Vietnam or what have you. Then you've got Thailand, which is again, you know, around like $8,000 US dollars GDP per capita, a little bit more of a middle-income country. But you know, if you look at Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam, we're talking markets, you know, that are between like $2,500, $3,000 GDP per capita and $4,000, right? And so monetizing in those markets is definitely a challenge. Now, I don't think it's impossible to monetize in Southeast Asia, right? And you do see some very successful businesses doing this. You know, there are a couple of examples, for instance, Pancake, also in the e-commerce enablement space in Vietnam, have done a terrific job of this. So, you know, definitely there is a lot of opportunity. But the price sensitivity is something that's very real and that's going to remain real in the years to come. And in fact, you know, if you're coming to Southeast Asia, you have to be playing the long game. You have to build a business today with the understanding that, you know, real monetization might only come, you know, in 5 to 10 years time, right? In the same way as when, you know, businesses like Alibaba were built, China was not near as wealthy as it is today, but it is only because they built it at that time when monetization would also have been difficult and the opportunities were quote unquote smaller, that you know they are able to dominate a market that is the size of China today. Right? And I think it's a similar situation in Southeast Asia. You have to be long-term oriented, you have to be playing the long game, and you have to be you know, willing to you know, take a ride on the growth of the broader region and be patient until that growth brings about its promise.
So Wilfred, businesses today, both corporations and startups, have really put forth this employee remote strategy, right? Especially in light of COVID. And for you as a company, when you guys started, your operating model was really focused around, very well said, Wilfred. And for people out there who are interested in catching a cup of coffee with you, what would be the best point of contact? So what have kind of been the pros and cons in building remotely? Starting fully as a remote company with a dozen people spread across 5 different countries?
Great question. It's also one that's you know, quite hard to answer. And especially at this time when we're slowly starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel, quote unquote, and companies around the world are starting to grapple with this question of, you know, the return to the office and what that's going to look like and, you know, what kind of format to adopt from like hybrid to full remote to fully in the office, etc. You know, I think everyone is grappling with the same questions, and I don't know that anyone has the definite answer to it yet. There was actually an HBR, the Harvard Business Review podcast recently about this very question with a professor from Stanford who specializes in the study of remote work, who's weighing in on this question. So that was actually a really interesting conversation, and I recommend people to have a listen if they're interested in this. But you know, more to Zappi and how we've been operating right now, it was not really even a question of whether we would be remote or not, because there wasn't really any option, right? And what we've discovered, because we had to build as a full remote company, is that you know, there are definitely some big positives. For one, we've been able to hire the best and the brightest in the broader region in a way that would not have been possible if we had restricted our attention to, say, you know, just Singapore, right? So you mentioned correctly that our team, you know, over a dozen people is spread out across 5 different countries. We've got people in from Singapore to India, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam. And these are really the best people that we were able to find for the role that we were hiring for. And so having this ability to hire regionally, as opposed to, you know, in a small place, say like Singapore, has definitely been a tremendous asset for us. At the same time, because we've been building remote from day one, we're building all the processes to enable us to function as a remote company and to function extremely productively, right? So week on week, you know, we're running retrospectives within the company. You know, what went right, what went wrong, what new tools might we be able to implement that can help us, you know, work better, et cetera, et cetera. And by this point, I think we built really a, you know, a hell of a system to allow us to operate in a way that I think companies that shifted from offline to online would not be able to do, right? So today we're operating, I'd say, extremely productively as a remote company. Now, the challenges come in the form of, you know, building team culture, bonding, team building. And, you know, we've tried out and we continue to try out things like, you know, virtual offsites and virtual like coffee breaks, et cetera. But there is, you know, let's be frank, a part of human interaction and an important one at that, that just can't be replaced with these virtual like hangouts and meetups and what have you. Especially when you start looking at larger organizations, I do doubt the ability of those organizations to thrive in a fully remote setting. Now we've got sort of standard bearers in the industry. You know, I'm thinking notably of Basecamp that have been you know, touting the ability or even like the necessity of the long term companies operating remotely. But you know, again, Basecamp is a I have a huge amount of respect for Basecamp, and it's a very interesting company. But the scale of Basecamp is also, you know, relatively limited. You know, a couple dozen people, right? If you start to expand that to hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of people, I do have my doubt that you can operate as effectively in a fully remote setting. So going forward, what we'll be doing when it is possible to do so is we'll be experimenting around, you know, hybrid systems of work with people coming back in the office, you know, a couple of days a week and staying remote, you know, the rest of the time. However, I think, you know, that is going to be done carefully in steps, progressively, and very much intentionally, right? So I think you need to have a plan when you go back to, you know, the office or when you decide on hybrid work, et cetera, because you don't want to come up with a situation where, you know, you didn't think it through. It's a free for all. Everyone decides, you know, this person's going to be remote and that person's going to be in the office. And, you know, in the end, when, you know, you've got half your team in the office at the same time as the other half is remote, then you've got some discrepancies, statistically speaking, in the rate of, say, like promotion of people who go to the office versus work remotely. And given that, you know, people who decide to go in the office also not, you know, a random sample of the population, but very much kind of self-selected groups, for instance, you know, mothers are more likely to want to work remotely. And so if you know, add to that the tendency to be promoted at a lesser rate, then that creates an issue of, you know, discrimination against certain groups, right? So I think you need to be very aware of all these issues and these risks, have a plan, and then be willing to iterate on it to, you know, get to the most optimal sort of work setup for your company.
And Wilfred, to wrap up our call with our last question for today, what piece of advice would you give to our listeners out there from the journey you have had so far in life?
It would be a little bit, you know, it feels a bit presumptuous for me to be giving, you know, advice at this stage. You know, at my stage, which is still very early on, you know, more than that, I love to take advice from people who are, you know, a little bit further down the road from me. So, you know, I feel in very much a privileged position and it's slightly awkward with you, you know, asking me this question, because I definitely don't feel like we've made it yet. We still have a huge amount of work to do and we really need to prove ourselves. But, you know, with my sort of like short amount of experience in this space, two things I'll mention in this vein is, first of all, like, I think intentionality played a big part in helping me get to where I am right now. It was definitely in my line of sight to start a business as soon as I could. And I did that with a lot of preparation, right? So I started working on businesses throughout university, which provided, you know, very much like a safe space where, you know, the risk of failure or like rather the cost of failure was very low, and where I could, you know, experiment, the sandbox in that sense. And that actually played a big part in, you know, helping me launch that first business and run that first business, gain the experience of running a business, and then move on, you know, to other projects. So I'd say intentionality is the first one that I put in there. And I see a lot of people around me who, you know, want to be entrepreneurs and say they want to start something, etc. But they're waiting for the right idea or for the right person or something like that. And the truth of the matter is, I spent, you know, the past years thinking acutely every day about, you know, what it is we could be doing, who we could be working with, who I could be working with, what projects I could be, you know, working on, analyzing markets, etc., working together with people, talking through these things to get to where I am. So the fact of the matter is that I think that eureka moment of this is, you know, what I should be working on is a little bit of a, in most cases, is a little bit of a fantasy. And actually determining what you should be working on, who you should be working with, you know, takes a lot of work. And the more intentional you are about this, about, you know, thinking, you know, analyzing markets, analyzing business opportunities, reading up about, you know, companies of interest, speaking to people about these ideas, et cetera, the closer you're going to get to being able to actually start a business. And when it comes to like finding a co-founder, you know, again, it's the same. You've got to put yourself out there and, you know, create the conditions for you to succeed. So the first one that I'll put out there is intentionality. And the second one, you know, which gets mentioned all the time, but I think is really the secret sauce to all this, or the not so secret sauce to all this, is perseverance, right? Perseverance. I know that with my first business, we had some high highs and some very low lows. But even when we experienced those low lows, we kept going at it, kept, you know, hacking away. And I think that that is really what has enabled that business to, you know, continue to grow, continue to do well, and which has enabled me, you know, to keep going at it with a second business. And in fact, you know, Zappi is the third project that I worked on throughout 2020. You know, I was working on two other projects in the first sort of like three quarters of 2020 that didn't pan out. But you know, I definitely you know, I knew what I was in it for. I knew that I wanted to stop almost at nothing to start this next thing and to make it a success. And you know, I kept my head down and kept working at it until it succeeded. And again, I don't think I could have done it had I not, you know, planned things out and, you know, had this first business, you know, running on the side, etc. So again, this comes back to my first point about being prepared. But, you know, once you've got that in place, you just got to be persevering. So if I had one, you know, two points to hammer out, it would be those two.
Very well said, Wilfred. And for people out there who are interested in catching a cup of coffee with you, what would be the best point of contact?
I'm always very happy and very open to meeting new people, to speaking with people, you know, to exchanging ideas, etc., and best practices. So if you want to reach me, a good place is LinkedIn. I'm unfortunately not a Twitter head, so that won't be the right place to get in touch. But feel free to, you know, put my LinkedIn URL in the bio, and I'm more than happy to connect with folks there.
Wilfred, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for inviting.